Chuck Collins, welcome to KABU.
Hey, Bill. Great to be with you.
Chuck Collins directs the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies. He also writes articles and books and economic studies as well. One of his studies is Billionaire Bonanza, about the share of wealth going to the 1%. He also wrote a book, Wealth Inequality and Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. I mentioned that book because it sums up what we're going to do in today's interview. It's our topics today on The Old Mole. So, Chuck, you spent like close to 40 years, most of your adult life, exposing income inequality, and yet every year it gets more pronounced. What's the story?
Well, that's kind of discouraging, Bill.
Why haven't you done it better?
It's true. It just happens my life coincided with these 40 years of moving more and more toward greater wealth and income inequality. The concentration of wealth is now at kind of a Gilded Age levels. There's no single cause for that, but we're now looking at a situation where three billionaires have as much wealth as the bottom half of the U.S. household. And if we don't intervene, we're just going to be continue to move in that direction. So we're living in a time of kind of fantastic extreme inequality.
And it seems to me it's not just the inequality, it's the change in the economy towards, for most people, probably the bottom 80%, extreme precariousness of income and life prospects. It was always bad for working people, and especially bad for the poor, but that's really intensified a whole lot, you know, one heartbeat away from destitution. It seems to me that's...
I think that's really the real story. We now know the ranks of what I call underwater nation are growing. You know, people who have nothing to fall back on, zero or negative net worth. That's 20% of the population. The next 20 are pretty much precariously, you know, one paycheck away from insecurity, destitution, and even creeping into what we consider the middle class. I mean, home ownership rates are coming down. Savings rates have come down, and that sense that the sands are shifting under people's feet. So at least 60% of the population, and if you take away debt and the sort of the way in which debt masks the real decline in people's standard of living, then you're right, Bill. We're talking like 70-80% of the population is slowly going downhill. Some of going faster than others, but seeing a deterioration and a rise in precariousness.
One thing that people have fallen back on is not just, but a sort of family wealth. Working class people who are able to buy a home in 40s, 50s, 60s, even the 70s, early 70s at least, who had income and could buy a home and they were reasonably cheap, and wealthy people weren't buying up all property and jacking up rents and costs. Now families are doubling up, right, in that family home. But that, of course, is now eroding. I mean, that the equity is eroding to some extent in lots of places. But even more than that, they can't depend on that source of income. That seems to me, there's been a huge hollowing out of the wealth of the bottom 75% or so. That is, they have really, not only are jobs precarious because companies can move, but they don't have the cushion. And black people, of course, have no cushion at all, generally, and Hispanic people in this country.
No, I think that's a good analysis. And on the other hand, the other interesting part of that story is, so people in the top fifth or the top 10% are helping their kids and the next generation with all kinds of advantages, including, you know, here's a home, here's small amounts of capital, here's large amounts of capital. So at the top, you have affluent families helping their kids kind of like stay well above water, whereas the bottom 80%, to the extent they had home ownership or have some savings, they can't really buffer the downward fall of the next generation. So it's slowly eking away. We as a country kind of like are, oh yeah, home ownership, we're all about home ownership. But the home ownership rate has been going down steadily for 10 years. What does that mean? It means people are losing their homes, or they're not able to get in them if they were denied in the first place.
You know, one of the crises that it seems to me is going to happen fairly soon, it's slowly building, is retirement. People don't have retirement. People have 401ks with the wealthy ones have maybe $50,000 into it. That turns out to be really nothing in comparison to their needs. They're going to be completely dependent on Social Security, if Social Security is not eroded by the Trump administration. I don't think they're going to touch that third rail, though. I sort of hope they do. That will be their extinction.
No, we are kind of drifting into a deep retirement crisis. People don't have any cushion. Long-term health care costs are kind of going stratospheric. We hope Social Security remains solvent, you know, for another generation, but younger people are pretty skeptical that after the boomers cash out, will there be anything left? So I think that fact that we had 50, 60 years where the elder poverty rate was going down and people were not living in destitution in their final decades. Now I think we're going to see a return to that sort of pre-depression retirement experience where people just work till they die.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Chuck Collins, who directs the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Chuck, it's grim, and it makes it even more grim. We even can't get into it, is that we're destroying the environment, which is the basis of all wealth and production, and it could get really much, much worse in terms of just food prices and things like that, and we're not even factoring any of that in. But at least at this point and in the world, there's immense, immense productive capacity, and it could be done environmentally sustainable. There would be a lot of industries that gone, but it could have comfortable lives for everybody without any trouble. It seems I want to get to that at the end, but let's talk about just for a few minutes the impact of the tax law. And Trump ran on his great devotion to working people and their welfare. What about the tax law? Who gets the benefit of it?
Well, the tax law that passed in the fall was kind of masterfully designed to throw a little bit of tax benefits to people in the middle, working people who may get an extra dollar a week or a couple extra dollars in their paychecks. But the goal of that was to package a $1 trillion corporate tax cut and then another $500 billion for mostly wealthy people. So 85% of these tax cuts are going to go to the richest 1%. And then they rolled it out masterfully in a way. They had all these corporations announcing these bonuses at the same time. So it sort of created that illusion that this was really going to help ordinary people. What's interesting is people didn't fall for it. They didn't fall for it while it was happening. Large majority of people opposed this tax cut. They understood that the other shoe would drop, that it was going to lead to cuts in things like Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare, and was going to lead to more austerity. And they also knew that it was mostly going to go to the rich and that trickle-down economics doesn't work. So the good news, and there really is actually a lot of good news here, is people didn't fall for it. They rammed it through because they had the votes and the power to get their tax cut. It was essentially a grab. And it's still going to be debated. The Republicans are going to go out there. But even in this special election in Pennsylvania where Connor Lamb won the seat, the Republican tried to run on these tax cuts saying, hey, look, we delivered this tax cut. And people were just like, go away. We know that's bogus. Like, they dropped that as a message like several weeks before the election.
Oh, really? They dropped it?
Went back to the bread and butter anti-immigration stuff, which is what Trump did, you know, last week in his press conference. He, you know, was supposed to talk about taxes, and he threw away his paper, and he just went back on his immigration rant. Again, because the tax cut isn't going to sell. It isn't going to get the votes that they think it's going to get.
There has to be continued exposure of it, clearly.
Yeah. For instance, though, people who opposed the tax could have been really smart. Like, there's a lot of small business people stepping up saying, we didn't really get anything that was promised here. People pointing out that corporations are mostly using their tax cut to buy back their stock, not to increase wages or invest in things that are going to create jobs. They're not interested in creating more jobs. They're just trying to deliver for their shareholders. So there's good pushback onto the narrative that somehow that tax cut's going to help people.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Chuck Collins, who's the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Chuck, before we get to what can be done about it, tell us about your program and your website and why people, if they want to learn a lot more about inequality and what to do about it.
Here's what I think is the good news, Bill, is people are really awakening right now, both for the environmental ecological reasons you mentioned, as well as these extreme inequalities you know, on a very gut level, people understand that this isn't sustainable. And there are these different movement formations. I mean, we saw young people marching against guns, the Poor People's Movement campaign, which is emerging, the William River and Barber on April 10th will be launching the next phase of that campaign. And the Institute for Policy Studies, where I work, has been working with Reverend Barber, preparing his reports. And all across the country, I know in Portland, but where I live in Boston, there are active chapters gearing up for a month of campaigning and resistance. And it really brings together both poor people's issues, environmental issues, and concerns about militarism. I mean, it's a very unifying tent, if you will. So I'm encouraged by that. And if you go to Institute for Policy Studies or go to inequality.org, which is the website I co-edit, you can find ways to plug in if you're not already plugged in, and check out the report being released Tuesday the 10th on the Poor People's Movement and their policy campaigns.
It does seem so exciting, has so much possibility. It actually feels to me a little bit like the early days of the civil rights movement, but a little better organized even, and multiracial right at the beginning.
Yeah, and I think if people haven't heard the Reverend Barber or seen him, they should find a way, you know, when he comes to Portland or when he's in, see his press conferences and videotapes, because he is one of the rising leaders of our time. And I've sat in the room with him many times. He's in enormous physical pain just from, you know, sort of back and spinal issues, and he travels nonstop. He's essentially sacrificed his life and his body to build this movement. And I encourage people to check him out and follow and join what the Poor People's Campaign is doing right now.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the other signs that are so heartening. The environmental movement, I think, is going to join it. There's so much discussion of where we need to create really good work that's in fact necessary to save the planet and all over the globe. And also changes in agriculture are absolutely necessary, and that also will require in many ways more intensive cultivation instead of industrial agriculture. There's plenty for people to do, and it will all be productive work rather than selling stocks or whatever pieces of paper to other people and predating on this vast machine that's just juggling paper and taking its profits. That's part of it. And then there's the 15 Now campaign and organizing by low-wage workers in this country. What do you make of it all?
Well, I see the same trends, Bill. I see people coming together around this environmental movement. I think people understand we have to stop the bad, stop the fossil fuel industry, divest from that, move capital out of that speculative dinosaur economy and move it into the new economy, including this vibrant agricultural sector that was figuring out how to capture and sequester carbon, pulling down carbon out of the atmosphere using new grazing practices and relocalizing agriculture, using the earth and soil as a giant carbon sponge. These are things we can do something about. We need to both stop the bad, stop Exxon and the ravages of this push to build new fossil fuel infrastructure, but we also have agency in a lot of places to practice regenerative agriculture. So I think that is one of the, and to see the numbers of young people who get that, who are actively putting their lives into stopping the bad and building the new, is one of the bright signs right now.
You told me earlier you were working with cities to try and restructure themselves and create jobs and use all of the great wealth that's still available. Tell us about that. Changing agriculture is one thing. Changing the whole energy system, localizing it, not having to rely on hugely expensive, globe-spanning, environmentally destroying grids, and the local can be democratically run and is more resilient and cheaper, and it creates a lot of good jobs. Are cities thinking about that? I know some cities have, in fact, begun that task, like Boulder, Colorado, and several others. Tell us about that. Is that one of the programs in cities for reconstructing themselves?
Yeah, I think that there are cities are places where people are facing these issues much more than the federal policymakers are, obviously, because they're completely captured by the wealthy and fossil fuel interests. But cities are saying, hey, how do we make this transition to the post-fossil fuel economy? How do we rebuild a healthy, local, resilient economy? How do we de-link from the most destructive aspects? And cities are contested. I mean, what I've been looking at is the role of global capital coming in from all over the world into cities, trying to buy up real estate, buy up land, build new structures. You see this Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, down the coast. But where I live in Boston, New York, the coastal cities now are giant wealth storage units for the global rich. They're not buying these units and houses to live in. They're buying them as ways to hold their capital, because capital has to touch down somewhere. Can't all stay up in the stratosphere of paper and digital. So the billionaire class are trying to diversify their wealth, and they're buying up properties. And we should use leverage there in exchange for creating a safe haven for capital. Our city should tax high-end real estate transactions. We should be taxing speculation and vacant properties and investing in permanently affordable housing, investing that money in land trusts and cooperatives and housing that's rooted and affordable for people who live in Portland and other places. And I see that movement happening in all over the country. You know, in the East Coast, we're trying to get all the cities to move in tandem and pass similar legislation to tax high-end real estate. It's kind of like the old maxim in nature, which is sometimes the solution to an ailment is right next to the ailment. You know, like poison ivy, right next to it is growing jewelweed, which heals the itchiness. Well, it's the same principle. You have a deep problem of affordable housing. Let's tap this reservoir of super rich people's housing and fund expanded affordable housing.
Extracting from the rich now seems to me absolutely necessary and the only way we're going to survive.
Capital is moving so fast that we have to catch it where it lands, which is in our cities right now.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Chuck Collins, we've run out of time, so it was really good talking to you.
Great talking to you always, Bill.
Thanks a lot.